Tonight, we are very excited to be welcoming Rabbi David Nachbar, who is teaching at TIM for the first time. Rabbi Nachbar is an alumnus of the rabbinical school, the graduate school, and the Kol HaEliyon of Yeshiva University. Right now, he is Magid Shir at GPAT, the graduate program for advanced Talmudic studies for women at Yeshiva University, and is also on the Faculty of Judaic Studies at the Torah Academy of Bergen County. I had a little early look at the sources that Rabbi Nachbar has brought for us today, and I've been looking forward to this year all day. So, yeah, take it away.
Thank you so much. Let me open by thanking Rabbi Kelman for the invitation to share Divrei Torah and to share together with you this evening. Just to add to Maxine's description, one of the privileges that I have at teaching at GPath is also that I have the opportunity to teach Atara Kelman, Rabbi Kelman's daughter. That probably should go at the top of the list of all the other opportunities. And I thank Rabbi Kelman for the invitation to give this year tonight, and also wanted to thank Maxine for all of her assistance in preparing and allowing the availing all of you of the Makorot that I shared. Just to reiterate what Maxine had requested, if there are any questions that come up, please feel free to share them and to type them into the chat. And hopefully we'll have a chance toward the end of this year to address them. What I'd like to accomplish and focus on together with you over the course of this evening's shiur, my objective is to explore the relationship between the universal norms and human expectations that are expected of all of humanity, and our specific and more particular covenantal imperatives and commands that are commanded to us specifically because of our covenant that was given at Sinai. What is the relationship? What is the dynamic between these universal human norms on the one hand and the more particular covenantal imperatives on the other? Is the Jewish people's more particular covenant established through the giving of the Torah at Sinai, was that meant to supplant and to uproot the prior, more universal human norms? Or are those always in place? And the covenant at Sinai was simply meant to supplement and to add on top of that, but never to supplant or to uproot the human expectations, the human norms that are expected of all human beings. I'd like to explore that relationship together with you this evening, and to explore the tension that exists within the Rambam's writings surrounding this issue, and to try to analyze the fundamental debate between Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivat Har Etzion during the last century, extending into this century, and his Rabbi, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn, and to try to analyze their fundamental debate regarding this relationship, universal human norms on the one hand, and particular covenantal norms and imperatives on the other. And in truth, this time of the calendar is a good opportunity to explore this particular topic, because in last week's Parsha in Parshas Bereishis, and in this week's Parsha in Parshas Noach, we find the Torah introducing us to the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, to those expectations, to those norms that apply universally to all of humanity. In last week's Parsha, in Parshas Bereishis, the Torah tells us, "Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al ha'adam le'mor, mikol eitz hagan achol tochel." We have the very first mitzvah that is issued to humanity, "Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al ha'adam." And the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin and Daf Nun Vav Amud Beis sees within that pasuk in Parshas Bereishis a hint at the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach that apply to all of humanity, the universal norms that are expected of every human being. Avodah Zarah, not to worship idolatry. Gilui Arayos, illicit sexual relationships. Shfichus Damim, murder. Gezel, theft. Eber Menachai, consuming meat from a living, a flesh from a living animal. Dinim, justice, law. And Birkas Hashem, the prohibition against blaspheming and cursing the name of Hashem. The Gemara sees hints to each of these Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, to each of these universal human norms within the pasuk in last week's parsha. In addition, the Gemara also sees hints to a different set of seven mitzvos, a different set of Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach in the psukim in this week's parsha, in Parshas Noach. If you take a look at my shared screen for a moment, just to look at the source sheet together. I know it was shared, anyone who had a chance to print it out, but if you didn't print it out, it's on my shared screen. Please give me a thumbs up if you could see my shared screen. Yes? So if you look at in source number one, we find a reference to the Isra of Avodah Zarah, worshiping idolatry, and also Gilui Arayos, illicit sexual relations, in the opening phrase here in source number one, Batishachis Haaretz Lefnei Halokim. That term, hashchasa, depravity, in the Gemara's mind, is a reference both to Avodah Zarah and also to Gilui Arayos. Furthermore, in source number two, a couple of psukim later, the Gemara also sees within the phrase in Pasuk Chaf, Meha'uf Liminehu, the prohibition against interbreeding and maintaining the certain order that God created the world with. And in source number three, we have numerous references to several avirot that are part of the universal human norms. So in Pasuk Gimel, in source number three, Kierek Esav Nasati Lachem Et Kol, that which is ownerless, that you're allowed to take and eat for yourself. But theft is prohibited. Pasuk Dalet, Ach Basar B'Nafsho Damo Lo Tochelu, this is the prohibition to eat flesh from a living creature. Pasuk Vav, Shofech Dam Ha'adam, Ba'adam Damo Yishofech. This is the prohibition against murder. And finally, in Pasuk Zayin, Vatem Pruervu, this the Gemara believes might establish a seventh mitzvah, different than the list that we're familiar with, perhaps, the prohibition against castration. That is rooted in Pasuk Zayin, Vatem Pruervu. So both in last week's parsha and also in this week's parsha, we find the Torah introducing us to the universal human norms, the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach, that are incumbent upon all human beings. And the question we have to wonder about is post-Sinai, once the Jewish people have established a more particular, exclusive covenant with God through the giving of the Torah at Sinai, what happens to our participation? What happens toward the integration of all Jewish people within those universal human norms? Is the more particular covenant that we established at Sinai meant to supplant and to uproot our participation in that other system of law? Or perhaps, is that a given? Of course, we're members of humanity with everyone else. We share the same expectation and norm and responsibilities that are expected of us no different than any other human being. But on top of that, the covenant at Sinai is meant to supplement those universal norms. That's the question I would like to focus on together with you this evening. There's a fundamental debate that helps address this particular question in the Mishnah Masechet Chulin on Daf Kuf Amid Bet. Again, if you take a look, please, at my shared screen. The Mishnah in Chulin in source number four is addressing the Isser of Gidan Asha, the Isser to eat the sciatic nerve of an animal, which was first introduced after Yaakov Avinu's bout of wrestling with the Sar the mysterious Ish, in Parshas Vayishlach. And following that event, as Yaakov came away hobbled and due to his physical injury, the Torah there introduces us to the Isser of Gidhanasha, the Isser to eat from the sciatic nerve of an animal. And the Mishnah in Chulin, in source number four, introduces us to a fundamental debate between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda regarding the application of that prohibition to eat the Gidan Asha. And if you look at the Mishnah source number four, the Mishnah quotes the position of the Chachamim, Noheg b'tahora ve'enu noheg b'tmeya. The prohibition against eating the Gidan Asha applies to a behema tahora, to a kosher animal that Jews are allowed to eat from. But that Isra of Gidan Asha does not apply to a behema tmeya, a non-kosher animal, which anyway you are prohibited to consume. In the Chacham's opinion, if the animal is already prohibited because it is a non-kosher animal, there is no need, nor is there an ability, for the additional Isra of Gidan Asha, the additional prohibition of Gidan Asha, to apply to that animal. And therefore, the Isra only applies to kosher animals, not to non-kosher animals. And Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with the Chachamim, and Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion that it applies af bitmeya. It also applies to non-kosher animals. And in exploring the underlying logic and rationale behind each opinion, the Mishnah continues and provides us with Rabbi Yehuda's argument to the Chachamim in expanding the scope to include even non-kosher animals. And if you look at the Mishnah in source number four, Rabbi Yehuda argues, Am Rabbi Yehuda, the Halo Mibne Yaakov Nesar Gid Hanasha. The Isra of Gid Hanasha is recorded already in Parshas Vayishlach, well before Matan Torah at Sinai. At that point in time, there was no notion of kashras, of kosher animals and non-kosher animals. And since the Isra of Gid Hanasha was introduced before Matan Torah, before Har Sinai, and at that point there was no distinction between kosher and non-kosher animals, it follows from that the Isra of Gid Hanasha should apply to both types of animals, both kosher and non-kosher animals. So at that point in time, at that juncture in history, Adayin Behemot Tmei Mutarit Lahen, those non-kosher animals were still permitted for the Bnei Yaakov, for the sons of Yaakov, to eat and to enjoy. The Chacham's response to Rabbi Yehuda is very telling. And they argue back, B'Sinai Ne'amar, the Isra of Gid Hanasha was introduced at Sinai, and that's where our prohibition dates back from. If it's recorded in Parshas Vayishlach, it was simply recorded by Moshe Rabbeinu around the event that inspired the prohibition. But in truth, the prohibition was only introduced much later historically, only at Matan Torah, only when the Torah was given at Sinai. So the Chachamim respond, B'Sinai Ne'amar, it was really introduced at Sinai, Ela Shenichtav B'Mkomo, it was just written back at the time of the original event. That's not the time in history when the Isra was first introduced. It was only introduced later at Sinai. And since the Isra was only introduced at Sinai, at that point there was a distinction between kosher animals and non-kosher animals. So the prohibition is only relevant and meaningful for animals that we can otherwise eat, but not from the Gid Hanasha. So if we look at the Machloket, if you look at the debate in the Mishnah as it's presented, it would seem like the debate here between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim surrounds the historical background to when the Isra of Gid Hanasha was first introduced. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it was introduced during the time period of Bnei Yaakov. At that point, it was pre-Matan Torah. They had the status of being Bnei Noach, members of humanity. And as a result, the Isra, the prohibition, applies both to kosher and non-kosher animals. For the Chachamim, the Isra was introduced much later, only at Sinai. There was a distinction between kosher and non-kosher animals, so the Isra is more limited and only applies to a behema tahora. The Rambam, in his Perush HaMishnayos, in his commentary on the Mishnah Masechet Chulin, uses this Mishnah to explain the position of the Chachamim in a radically new light, and he does so in a way that touches upon our overarching conceptual question: what is the relationship between universal human norms on the one hand and particular covenantal imperatives on the other? And the Rambam here captures our attention because he says to us, when reading this Mishnah, pay careful attention. He actually uses those words. And when the Rambam instructs us to pay careful attention, it behooves us to pay careful attention to the concepts embedded within this Mishnah in Masechet Chulin. If you look at source number 5 with the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah, and if you look at the fourth line in, the Rambam tells us to pay careful attention. V'sim libcha leklal hagadol hazeh hamuva b'mishna zo. Pay careful attention. Focus carefully on this great principle that is embedded within the Mishnah in front of us. What is the great principle he has in mind? V'hu omram misinai ne'asar. When the Chachamim said that the Gid Hanasha's Aser, dating back only to Sinai, but not earlier to the time period of Yaakov and his children, the Mishnah did not mean to say that there was no Iser observed during the time period of Yaakov and his children. Of course, Yaakov and his children observed the Iser, even according to the Chachamim. What the Chachamim are arguing is that once the mitzvah was reintroduced at Sinai, that new particular covenantal command supplants and uproots any prior commandment that might have preceded it. So that if we're going to observe the prohibition of Gid Hanasha nowadays, it is not on account of the behavior of Yaakov and his children. It is only on account of the commandment that was given to Moshe at Har Sinai. The covenant that was established at Sinai supplanted any prior obligation or responsibility incumbent upon us as members of the more global human community. Rambam explains here, V'hu amram me'sinai ne'asar, this is the fifth line in, V'hu shatat sarich lada'at, we must know the following, Shekol ma shanu nizharim imanu, o osim oto hayom, any mitzvah that we perform nowadays, or any is or any prohibition that we acknowledge and adhere to nowadays, ein anu osim zot, ela mipnei tzivoy Hashem al yedei Moshe Rabbeinu. It is only on account of the commandment that was given to Moshe at Sinai. Lo mipnei she'Hashem tziva b'kach l'neviim shekadmuhu. Not because of the commandments given to prior prophets who lived before Moshe. Those commandments, those earlier commandments, are no longer relevant. Our observance of the commandments is only on account of the command that was given to Moshe at Sinai. And he gives three illustrations of this klal gadol, of this great principle. What are the three examples? Dugma lakach, for example, ein anu ochlem eiver menachai, lo mipnei shashem asar al bnei noach eiver menachai. If we don't eat flesh from a living animal, it's not because of the iser given to bnei noach in this week's parsha, ela mipnei shemoshe asar aleinu eiver menachai, b'mashen etzdava b'sinai, sheishar eiver menachai asar. It's only because the commandment was reissued to Moshe at Sinai. Furthermore, if we give our children, our sons, a bris milah on the eighth day, ein anu malim beglal she'avram malad atzmo v'anshei beito. It is not because Avram was commanded to give milah to his son Yitzchak and to Yishmael. Ela mipnei she'Hashem tzivanu aydei Moshe lihimo k'mo shemal Avram alav Hashem. It's only because Moshe was commanded in the mitzvah of bris milah. And finally, the isra of Gid Anasha, ein anu nimshachim ba'acharei iser Yaakov Avinu, el tzivoy Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't observe the iser of Gid Anasha because of Yaakov's command, rather because the command was reissued to Moshe at Sinai. Our observance of all the negative commandments, the mitzvot lo taseh, and the positive commandments, the mitzvot aseh, stem from the command given to Moshe, and not to any prior command given to earlier prophets within our history. And then he concludes by saying, Halotira Umram Shesh Miot Shloshesrei Mitzvot, Nemru Lo Moshe B'Sinai. There were 613 commandments given to Moshe at Sinai, which encompass and includes the prior Sheva Mitzvot given to Bnei Noach. They were reissued and recommanded at Sinai to Moshe Rabbeinu. So the principle the Rambam seems to be establishing here in his commentary to the Mishnah Masechet Chulin is that the covenantal commands that were issued at Sinai supplant, uproot any prior responsibility, any prior obligation, going back to a time period in which the Jewish people were not distinguished through the covenant at Sinai and were one, integrated fully with the rest of the human and global community. There's some support for the Rambam's view from a passage in Masechet Sanhedrin that you could see in source number 6, the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Nun Vav Amud Beis. And this this passage in the Gemara is adduced as a support for the Rambam's perspective, both by the Maritz Chayas, with Tzvi Hirsch Chayas in his commentary on Masechet Sanhedrin, and also in the comments of the Margolios Hayam, Rav Ruvain Margolios, in his work on Masechet Sanhedrin. If you look at the Gemara in source number 6, the Braisa and Sanhedrin and Daf Nuvav Amud Beis, the Braisa tells us that even before Sinai, the Jewish people were commanded in several mitzvot in the location of Mara. And the Gemara tells us that there were 10 commandments issued at Mara even prior to Matan Torah at Sinai. And the Braisa says, V'hatanya, Eser mitzvos nitzdavu Yisrael b'Mara. There were 10 commandments issued at Mara. What were they? Sheva shekiblu alehen b'nei Noach. The Sheva mitzvos b'nei Noach, the 7 commandments given, the 7 Noachide laws given to all of Bnei Noach, v'hosifu aleihen dinin, v'shabes, v'kibud ava'ein. And it was added at Mara 3 additional commandments. Number 1, dinim, the obligation to set up a court system, shabes, and also kibud ava'ein, honoring one's parents. And several of the commentaries struggle with the Gemara. If there were already 7 mitzvos Bnei Noach that were commanded previously, why does the Braisa state that 10 commandments were given at Mara? The Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach plus Dinim, Shabbos, and Kibud Ava'im. We were already commanded in those 7, simply by dint of the fact that we were members of the Bnei Noach, part of humanity. The Gemara should have said that 3 mitzvos were issued in Mara, only Dinim, Shabbos, and Kibud Ava'im. Why then does the Gemara say that 10 mitzvot were issued, the Sheva mitzvot Bnei Noach, plus Dinim Shabbos and Kibud Av Va'Em? So the Maritz Chayos, Rav Tzvi Hirsh Chayos, and Rav Reuven Margolios use this Gemara to support the viewpoint of the Rambam. It must be that our commandment, our obligation to observe the Sheva mitzvot Bnei Noach, no longer date back to the prior issuance of those commandments to Noach, to Adam, to Noach, and to subsequent generations. Our obligation in those commandments now stems from the reissuance of the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach to Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai and immediately beforehand at Mara. If you look at source number 7, at the comments of Rav Tzvi Hirsh Chayos, if you look at the second to last line in source number 7, he says toward the middle of the line, the in Cain, ilulei shenitztavu b'mara aydei Moshe Rabbeinu al zayin mitzvot bnei Noach, lo haya aleihem lachov. Were the Sheva mitzvot bnei Noach not reissued at Sinai, or not reissued to Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jewish people would have no obligation to adhere to those Sheva mitzvot bnei Noach, to those universal norms. And it's only because they were nitztavu mechadash, that they were reissued and recommanded to Moshe Rabbeinu as part of the rest of the Torah, is only on account of that the Jewish people are obligated in those universal norms, because they were reincorporated into a more particular covenant given to Moshe. So both the Maritz Chayos and the Margolios Hayam support the Rambam's view that our particular covenant supplanted the universal norms, based on the Rambam's passage in the Parashah Mishnayos in Chulin. They support that view from this Gemara in Masachet Sanhedrin. Rav Yitzchok Huttner, who again was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Chaim Berlin, was also the teacher of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. He writes about Rav Huttner in one of his essays published in the Jewish Action, The Source of Faith is Faith Itself. Rav Yitzchok Huttner adopted this fundamental perspective that the particular covenant of Sinai completely uprooted any prior obligation that was issued more universally to all of mankind, all of humankind. If you look at source number 9, we'll come back to the rest of it a little bit later on, but just to focus on one line in a letter that Rav Huttner wrote. If you take a look, please, at 5 lines in, he has a sharp formulation of this fundamental perspective when he writes, Ubarur dibishas matan Torah nifku mimenu kol hachovot shelifnei kach. He says it is clear to him. It is as clear as a summer day is long. Dibishas matan Torah nifku mimenu. The term nifku hafka'a means a complete uprooting, a complete supplanting of kol hachovot shelifnei kach, any obligation that might have been issued prior to that moment. Matan Torah completely supplanted all universal norms. This is the perspective of Rav Yitzchok Huttner, again, the teacher of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Rav Huttner supported his view from the issue of Shabbos. Shabbos for him was a test case, a litmus test, to weigh and to evaluate whether or not our particular covenant supplemented or supplanted the prior universal norms that applied to all of humanity. He notes that there's a pasuk in this week's parsha, in Parshas Noach, after the Mabul, when Hashem promises that he would no longer disrupt the complete functioning of the world through destruction, through decimation, and instead Hashem promises that there would no longer be a complete upheaval of the various seasons, of night and day, of the overturning of the earth. If you take a look at source number 10, toward the end of this week's parsha, in Pasuk Chaf Beis, Hashem promises us, Od kol yemei ha'aretz, zera v'katzir, v'kor v'chom, v'kaitz v'choref, v'yom v'layla, lo yishbosu. Hashem promises that the different seasons and the different climates and the systematic running of night and day, that will no longer be disrupted. Lo yishbosu, it will no longer cease, it will no longer be disrupted from their functioning, from their routine, from the patterns of regular everyday life. There will not be another mabul to disrupt that sort of perpetual, ongoing, both seasons and times, times of the day. The Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin, surprisingly, reads this pasuk in a very non-literal way and deduces from this pasuk another universal norm that applies to all of humanity. And the Gemara reads the final phrase in the pasuk, Lo Yishbosu, as not only teaching us that the seasons won't cease, and that the time period of day and night, one following the next, will no longer be disrupted. But in addition, it applies that final phrase, Lo Yishbosu, to all human beings. That all human beings, in light of this new opportunity, Lo Yishbosu, they should not rest. There's an obligation to be creative. There's an obligation to be productive, to contribute constructively towards society, to cultivate and to develop the world. Lo Yishbosu, we should never be shoves from doing malacha. We should never desist from being involved in creative work. Every single day, Lo Yishbosu, we must be involved in creative, constructive, productive activity. We cannot be shoves. We cannot rest. We cannot desist from doing malacha. Wondered Rav Huttner, if that's a universal human norm, if all human beings cannot be shoves, we have to be involved on a daily basis in constructive malacha, how is it that every seventh day the Jewish people observe Shabbos? How can we once a week, every single week, be shoves memlacha to the point that if we're not shoves, we're obligated, we're liable for the death penalty for capital punishment if a person does malacha on Shabbos? How is that possible? If there's a universal human norm to constantly, on a daily basis, be involved in constructive, productive activity, to be involved in creative work, how can we as a people be shoves every seventh day on the day of Shabbos? Rav Huttner reasoned, it follows from this, that it must be our particular covenant supplanted the universal norms that apply to the rest of humanity. And although there's a value of not being shoves mimlacha, of perpetually being involved on a daily basis in creative activity, the unique particular covenant of Sinai, which introduced us to the mitzvah of Shabbos, supplants and uproots those universal norms. And as a result, we are now commanded to observe the day of Shabbos. If you can please take a look at source number 12, Rav Lichtenstein summarizes this point of Rav Huttner in one of his essays in the book, By His Light. And he says here, he recounts, I recall years back, this is in source number 12, I recall years back hearing a talk by Mori V'Rabi, by my teacher, my master, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, regarding the relationship between Bris Avraham, the covenant of Avram, and Bris Noach, God's covenants with Avram and with Noach. As he put it, did Bris Avraham come on top of the foundation of Bris Noach, or was it meant to replace it? Is it built on top with Bris Noach as a foundation, or did it replace it? Rav Huttner wished to learn from Rabbeinu Yonah that the latter was the case. It completely replaced it. It uprooted it. And he took Shabbos as the test case. Jews, of course, are commanded not to work on Shabbos. However, Chazal interpreted the verse, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease, as teaching us that Bnei Noach are always obligated to work. In fact, a Gentile who refrains from malacha, from labor on Shabbos, is punished. Evidently, concluded Rav Huttner, the universal value of they shall not cease has been countervailed within our more specific Jewish context. Thus, the new bris is meant to replace the old. And this, of course, is consistent with what we saw in Rav Huttner's letter back in source number 9, in which Rav Huttner said, Ubaruar, it is clear to him, as a summer day is long, that Matan Torah was mafkia, it uprooted any prior obligation that was incumbent on all of humanity. So the new covenant supplants any prior universal human norm that might have applied to the Jewish people. Although this is Rav Huttner's perspective, it is challenged by another passage in the Rambam's writings. Because although Rav Huttner relies upon heavily on the Rambam's comments in his commentary on the Mishnah on Masechet Chulin that we saw earlier, the Rambam elsewhere also addresses this particular issue. But his portrayal there seems to differ fundamentally from his prior treatment in his commentary on the Mishnah. If you look back, please, at source number 8, this is the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, where he describes the development of the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach and the evolution of those universal norms into the full set of 613 commandments, the Tariq Mitzvos, that were given at Sinai to Moshe Rabbeinu. And if you look at the way he portrays that evolution, that development, he describes it not as a fundamental shift and a supplanting of any prior norm and responsibility, but rather, exactly as I said before, as a gradual evolution, an evolving process of adding mitzvah upon mitzvah until we get to the final number of 613. But it is a gradual evolutionary process rather than a radical shift in our system of law. Please take a look at source number 8. This is the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, Perek Tet Halacha Aleph, where the Rambam writes, Al shisha dvarim nitztava Adam harishon. Adam was commanded in 6 commandments. Al avodah zarah, not to worship idols. Al birkas Hashem, not to blaspheme the name of God. Al shfichus damim, not to murder. Al gilur arayos, illicit sexual relationships. Yal hagezel, theft. Yal adinim, regarding different civil monetary law. Afal pisha kulan hin kabbalah biadenu mimoshe Rabbeinu. Even though we have a tradition regarding these commandments from Moshe, please pay careful attention to the next phrase. V'hada'as notelahen. Our intuition and human logic also supports the existence of these norms and responsibilities. Michlal divrei Torah yera'eh shal edu nitztaveh. We can also infer these commandments from different phrases in the Torah, like I highlighted above in the introduction to the shiur. Notice, however, the Rambam argues here that there's a certain level of human logic and intuition that goes into these universal norms. He then says, Hosif lenoach aver menachai, shnemar ach basar b'nafsho damo lo tochelu. The 6 were added to when the Isser of aver menachai is introduced to Noach at the end of this week's parsha. Nimsu sheva mitzvos. 6 plus 1 equals 7. And then he continues, V'chein haya hadavar b'chol ha'olam ad Avraham. That was the state of universal norms until Avram arrived on the scene. Ba Avraham b'nitztava yeter al elu b'mila v'hu hitpalo shachris. The mitzvah of Mila was added during the time period of Avram, and in addition, he also engaged in the behavior of davening shachris in the morning. Yitzchak hifrish ma'aser. Yitzchak separated, tithed his produce. V'hosif tefila acheres lifnos hayom, and furthermore, he added the tefila of mincha toward the end of the day. Yaakov hosif gidanasha. Yaakov added the commandment, the prohibition, to eat from the gidanasha. And in addition, v'hitpalel arvis yidavin mariv, in the evening. And then the Rambam adds cryptically, uv'mitzrayim nitztave amram b'mitzvos yiseros. There were multiple mitzvos yiseros that were introduced during the time period of Amram in Mitzrayim. And then the Rambam adds the following concluding phrase, and this is the phrase that causes great consternation to Rav Huttner's thesis. Ad sheba Moshe Rabbeinu v'nishlama Torah al yado. Until Moshe Rabbeinu came along, v'nishlama Torah al yado. When the Torah was more fully fleshed out and completed and rounded out to the number 613. The term nishlama, it was completed, sounds like this is not uprooting prior norms. This is not supplanting the prior norms. It is supplementing it. It is completing it to the number 613. How does Rav Huttner, who firmly believes as a davar barur, as a clear and certain matter, that the new covenant supplanted the old covenant, how does he interpret this phrase in the Rambam's writings in Hilchos Malachim, that Moshe Rabbeinu was mashlim, he simply completed and rounded out the number 613, the system of law that existed beforehand, rounded it out, completed it up to the number of 613. It was a hashlama rather than a hafka'a. It was a completion rather than an uprooting. So Rav Hutner struggles with this point in the letter that he wrote to a colleague of his. If you look back at source number 9, he struggles, but nonetheless explains that passage in source number 8 in accordance with his own thesis. And if you take a look, 7 lines from the bottom, he explains that phrase in the Rambam's writings, and he explains it in the following fashion. V'hach dekasav ha-Rambam shenishlama ha-Torah al-yidei Moshe Rabbeinu. Notice the bolded nishlama, it was completed. What did Rambam mean by that? Especially if my theory is correct. Kavanaso hi b'klaliyut ha-giluy shel ritzono shel makom b'chovos ha-adam. What was completed during the time of Moshe Rabbeinu was God's revelation to humanity of his will, of his expectations of us. Ki inyan ze shel gilui chovato shel adam ba'olamo, the revelation of God's expectations for our human behavior in this world was an ongoing evolutionary process. Nimshachu, it extended and continued, me'adam harishon, ad shenistayim etzel Moshe Rabbeinu, it began during the time period of Adam Harishon, at the dawn of history, and it continued in an unfolding, ongoing type of way until it was completed during the time period of Moshe Rabbeinu. U'me'az v'hala, ein od chidushim b'chovot ha'adam liyotzro, there is no new revelation as to what a person, what a human being's obligation in this world consists of. There is no new addition to that revelation of God's expectations of us. V'rak l'zehit kaven ha'rambam shenishlama ha'torah al yado, klomar, sh'al yado shel Moshe, ba'li de siyum ha'malach shel chidush chovot ha'adam liyotzro, ayidei gilui ritzono yitbarach. What Rav Hutner is saying here is that the revelation of God's will, his expectations of human beings, that was an evolutionary process. But when it reached its concluding point with Matan Torah at Sinai to Moshe Rabbeinu, that new covenant, nonetheless, is what obligates us in all mitzvos, and it supplanted, it uprooted any prior obligation dating back to an earlier form and an earlier point in history prior to that moment. So indeed, the revelation process was an ongoing type of development, but nonetheless, the conclusion of that process, Matan Torah at Sinai, that covenant uprooted us from any prior obligation prior to that moment. This is the way Rav Hutner explains that challenging passage in the Rambam's writings. Rav Lichtenstein, despite his respect and awe and reverence for his teacher, took a decidedly different approach from Rav Hutner in analyzing the relationship between the universal human norms introduced at the dawn of history and the more particular covenantal imperatives that were commanded at Sinai. And he addressed Rav Hutner's proof regarding Shabbos, that if there is a universal value of constant productivity and creative work, how do the Jewish people observe the day of Shabbos? Doesn't that prove to us that the new covenant replaced the old? And he addressed that very proof in the second paragraph here in source number 12, and he does so in the following manner. He argues, I do not adopt this general approach. In fact, I think quite the contrary is true. I adopt a contrarian view against Rav Hutner's thesis. Whatever is demanded of us as part of Knesset Yisrael does not negate what is demanded of us simply as human beings on a universal level, but rather it comes in addition. It doesn't supplant, it supplements. And regarding the proof from Shabbos, he says in parentheses, regarding Shabbos, let me just briefly note that the sanctity of Shabbos does not abrogate the universal value of work, but rather adds an additional element to the picture. If we have a mitzvah of Shabbos, it does not abrogate in any way the same universal value of productivity, of constructive work, of creative contributions to the world on the part of any member of the Jewish people. That universal norm applies to the Jewish people no less now than it did previously. Just on top of that, there's an additional value to be shoveis one day a week to commemorate God's activity during Sheshes Yimei Breishis, and also in addition, Yitzias Mitzrayim, that establish a more particular relationship between God and the Jewish people. But the universal value of having a good work ethic and engaging in creative, constructive activity every other day of the week, that certainly is still obligatory upon every member of the Jewish people. And to support his perspective, Rav Lichtenstein quoted a remarkable passage in the Mechilta Drashbi, which is the halachic medrash, one of the halachic medrashim on Sefer Shmos. On the pasuk in the Aseres Hadibros, Sheshes Yamim Tavo Vasisa Kom Lachtecha Vayom Hashvi'i Shabbas Hashem Elokecha, the Mechilta has the following remarkable comment. Sheshes Yamim Tavod is juxtaposed to resting on the seventh day. That juxtaposition is instructive, says the Mechilta. Rebbe Omer, Harezo Gzeira Acheras. This is a new command. Sheshes Yamim Tavod is a command. For 6 days you shall work. You shall be engaged in creative, constructive activity. Shekishem shenitzdavu Yisrael al mitzvas aseh shel Shabbos, kach nitzdavu al hamalacha. In the same way that the Jewish people were commanded to cease from engaging in creative activity on Shabbos, to be shoveis on the day of Shabbos, to that same degree they were commanded to engage in constructive activity the other 6 days of the week. So argued Rav Lichtenstein, we see that the universal value of creative constructive activity was not supplanted by the bris, the covenant at Sinai. It was simply supplemented with a new value of Shabbos. But it in no way abrogates us from that universal norm that certainly still applies. To the same degree we're commanded to rest on the seven, we are commanded to engage in melacha during the other 6 days of the week. This Rav Lichtenstein furnished as a support for his counter perspective that the new covenant at Sinai supplements, it does not supplant the prior universal norms. He also quoted a controversial position that's found in the Mechilta, the second halachic medrash on Sefer Shmos, in source number 14, where the Mechilta has a drasha, which again is somewhat of a controversial point, and one that should not be misconstrued or misunderstood. The pasuk there in Parshas Mishpatim says, "V'chi azir ish al re'ehu lehorgo be'orma, mi'im mizmechi tikachenu lamut." That if a person should rise up with malicious intent to murder another re'ehu, another member of his people, so he shall surely be taken to be killed. And the Mechilta has the drasha, but the emphasis here in the pasuk is on re'ehu, a member of his nation. And that comes the hotziat acherim, it comes to exclude someone who is not a member of the Jewish people. This exempts them from punishment. The act is absolutely forbidden, but it exempts them from a punishment. And to that, Isi ben Akiva is absolutely enraged. If you take a look, please, at source number 14, at line number 7, Isi ben Akiva responds to this halachic derivation and says, Eich yitachein, how is it possible? How is it possible there is no punishment for terminating human life? What does it matter whether it's another Jewish life or human life? How is it possible that that's not a punishable act? And his argument is one that directly addresses our overarching question this evening. He says, Isi ben Akiva Omer, Kodem Matan Torah, Hayinu Muzharim al Shvichus Damim. Before the covenant at Sinai, before Matan Torah, had any member of humanity terminated another life, other human life, they would surely be punished for such a heinous act. The Achar Matan Torah, Tacha Shehuchmaru Huklu? Does the covenant at Sinai in any way lessen our obligations? Does it lessen our sense of responsibility? How is that possible? The Emes Amru Pater Midine Basar Vadam V'dinan maser l'shamayim. Surely God has many ways of punishing this individual if he would engage in such a heinous act. The argument of Isi ben Akiva directly addresses our overarching questions. It is impossible, it is inconceivable, for the covenant at Sinai to in any way lessen the universal human norms that apply to all human beings. It is inconceivable. If anything, it only adds and supplements to those prior responsibilities, to those prior norms. And as such, it would be inconceivable that the laws of murder would in any way change or be modified subsequent to the covenant at Sinai. This too, Rabbi Lichtenstein used as a proof, as a support and demonstration that the new bris, the new covenant, supplements, but certainly does not supplant prior universal norms. In addition, he quoted one additional broad concept to further demonstrate his perspective. He quoted a passage in the Vayikra Rabba. If you take a look at source number 15, the Medrash Vayikra Rabba, in which the Medrash tells us the name of Rabbi Shmuel bar of Nachman, that Esrim Vishisha Doros Kadma Derech Eretz Es HaTorah, that 26 generations prior to the deliverance of the Torah to the Jewish people, the concepts, the values of Derech Eretz, the way that people engage and interact with one another, that was already given, that was already displayed 26 generations prior. Derech Eretz Kadma La Torah, it came before the deliverance of the Torah by 26 generations. And the Medrash derives this from a pasuk in last week's Parsha, in Parshas Bereishis, Dechsiv Lishmor Et Derech Eitz HaChayim. Derech is Derech Eretz. Eitz HaChayim, that is the Torah. But Derech first, before the Eitz HaChayim. Derech Eretz has to precede the deliverance of the Torah. And if you take a look at the commentary of the Eitz Yosef on that Medrash, he explains very beautifully, three lines from the bottom, in source number 15, that Sarich Ha'adam Lintoa B'libo Hamidot HaTovot B'chdesh Ayidezeh Tishkon HaTorah B'kirbo. A person must implant, must have midot tovot. They must refine their personality, their inner core character and personality, so that their soul can be a pleasant and fitting resting place, an abode for the teachings of the Torah. That unless one refines and cultivates one's inner character, one's inner personality, their inner soul cannot be an abode in which the Torah, its teachings, and its values can reside. And we see here a very important point. When the Medrash taught that Derech Eretz was Kadma La Torah by 26 generations, it wasn't only speaking in historical terms, that historically one preceded the other. It was speaking in axiological terms, in terms of values. There's an axiological priority that we must first cultivate and refine our inner core human character before we could possibly accept and study the Torah and have the Torah penetrate inward and reside within us. First, the more general universal human character and the refinement of character, that must come first, and only afterward can Torah find a fitting home. Rav Soloveitchik, in a famed essay that was subsequently written up and also translated from Yiddish into Hebrew, Yudim Ashul Kasefer Torah, that a Jew is comparable to a Sefer Torah, develops this point very beautifully. The words of the Torah, the words that are written on the parchment, cannot be written on any surface. They have to be written on parchment that is worked and treated for the sake of receiving the Kedusha of the words of the Torah. It cannot be written on any surface. It has to be written on parchment that is carefully and meticulously worked and treated so that it can house the ink and the letters of the Torah. And he said the same thing is true regarding a human being, regarding a Jew. If a person wants to receive the Torah and have the words of the Torah penetrate inward, they too have to work carefully and meticulously on working the parchment, treating the parchment, and our inner soul, our inner character, our attributes, that is the parchment upon which the words of Torah are inscribed, and that's Derech Eretz Kadma La Torah. Universal human norms, that's the foundation. That's the platform. That's the springboard for the more particular covenant, for the words of Torah that were delivered at Sinai. But to have one without the other, it'll never take root. As the commentary on the Medrash says in source number 15, Sarich ha'adam lintoa b'libo hamidot ha'tovot v'chdeish ha'idezet tishkon ha'torah b'kirbo. You must first prepare the groundwork, the parchment, so that afterward the words of Torah can take root in our heart and within our soul. So in Rav Lichtenstein's opinion, the contradiction between the Rambam's words in his commentary on the Mishnah and his words in Hilchos Melachim was the covenant at Sinai uprooting and supplanting of the prior universal norms, or do they supplement those norms? Was it Nishlama Torah al Yado, just the completion? Or is it all about the commandment given at Sinai, as he implied in his commentary on the Mishnah? Rav Lichtenstein said that in truth, it's both. They're both true. And if you take a look, please, at source number 17, he explains, similarly, I believe Matan Torah also needs to be understood in a dual fashion. At one level, Matan Torah was a wholly new departure. There was nothing like it before. One can indeed speak of Nitna Torah, V'nitchadsha Halacha, the Torah was given and the law was renewed. But in another sense, however, one can regard Torah not as a totally new chapter in human history, but rather as the pinnacle of the earlier development. Although in one perspective, Torah can be seen as unique and relating only to Knesset Yisrael, there is another perspective in which one can view Torah as being the highest stage in human development. One cannot achieve that greater development without a strong foundation that's rooted in the more universal human norms. So in Wilkinson's perspective, both points are true, but the foundation has to be placed. The careful, meticulous treatment of the parchment must be carefully and meticulously done and prepared in order for the words of Torah to then find a fitting abode, a fitting residence for their penetration. Thank you so much for listening. I'll stop this year at this point, just to open the floor. If there are any more general questions, I was not looking at the chat box as I was speaking. But if there are any questions on the development of the presentation, if you could please add them to the chat.
I think we can probably go ahead with the questions that are already in the chat. Okay. There are some really incisive ones there. So
okay. I'm looking forward to Maxine, hearing. if you don't mind, if you had a chance to read them already, I'm just processing them now. If you could direct me to one or to, if any one of them caught your eye, if you don't mind reading it out so that everyone can hear it. I wasn't reading it as I was speaking, if you saw any of them.
Okay. The first one is from Miriam, and she asks regarding Mara and the seven mitzvot Bnei Noach. I thought that the Jews were not obligated to them in the way that Bnei Noach are. So how were we given them at Mara? In some ways, Bnei Noach are more strict in some things.
Okay. So interesting point to raise. There is a passage in the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin, if I'm not mistaken, on Daf Nuntedem and Aleph, which the Gemara actually posits the following principle, whose full application has to be explored more carefully. But the basic premise is that there is nothing that the more global human community was commanded in, which a member of the Jewish people would not also be obligated in. Leka midam adinistavu b'bnei noach shehutar l'bnei Yisrael, or something to that effect. There's nothing that was commanded or prohibited to general humanity which a Jewish person would not also shoulder that obligation. That's the principle, that's the premise which the Gemara in Sanhedrin operates with. There are some more specific questions that come up in one case or another, but the baseline premise, you know, seems to be that, again, it adds, but it doesn't detract from those universal responsibilities. I see another question. If Bnei Noach only have seven laws, how is there also a rule that they must not rest on our Shabbos? Is that counted in the seven? Okay, excellent question. I see Esther Bergman asked it. Excellent question. In truth, the Gemara asked that question. So, Baruch Shekivant L'Divrei HaGemara. You intuited the Gemara's the very counter and the Gemara in the next line in that passage. The Gemara asked that exact question, and the Gemara responds by saying that the list of seven are only those mitzvot which are b'sheva al tase, which are passive or inactive, kind of like mitzvot lo tase. But those mitzvot which are the kum ba'aseh, that's not included on that list, although Bnei Noach are obligated in them. So that now becomes interesting. Is lo yishbos, which is formulated as a lo tase, as a negative commandment, is that passive? Is that inactive? Or is it really a mitzvah saseh to engage in constructive activity? So because it's treated as a mitzvah saseh, as a positive command to engage in constructive activity, perhaps that's why it's not on the list. But in truth, it is obligatory on Bnei Noach. So excellent question to ask. And again, Baruch Shekivant to the Gemara. Had you lived about 1600 years ago, you might have read your challenge, your question in the back and forth in that sugya. Let's see one more question here. Okay, I like that point as well. Having a common base serves as a unifying force that on many levels we stand shoulder to shoulder with the rest of humanity, not to step away from that. Okay. Thank you so much, everyone, for attending. I really appreciate the opportunity to learn together. Look forward to future opportunities as well. And wishing everyone good health and a wonderful new year. Take care, everyone. Have a good night.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. And just a reminder that tomorrow morning at 9:30, Rabbi Kelman is teaching his class on the Siddur and also on Sunday. So after Shabbat, Rabbi Menachem Leibtag is starting his new series on the biblical theme of seven. So yes, once more, thank you so much, Rabbi Nachbar. I think that was, a really wonderful way to introduce you to the community here. So thank you so much.
And my pleasure. Kol tov, everyone. Be well.